Good morning.
May it please the court. I'm Patty Stemler for the United States, and I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. This is a government appeal from an order denying restitution to two crime victims in a child pornography case, Amy and Vicky. The arguments with respect to Amy and Vicky are somewhat different. Today, I would like to focus on Amy. I think our arguments with respect to Vicky are pretty straightforward, and so I'm going to discuss today our arguments pertaining specifically to Vicky. When this court had before the case 2 years ago, it remanded for the district court to calculate anew the amount of the victim's losses, of Amy's losses, that were attributable to the defendant Monzel. When it went back down, the district court awarded no restitution and specifically made several findings against the government as to why it did not order restitution. And so I would like to start by addressing these specific findings. The government, as this court said, when it sent it back down, the government could either introduce additional evidence to show what losses were caused by Monzel, or it could offer a formula to apportion the losses among the group of individuals who caused those losses. When it went back down, the government offered a formula, which was to divide Amy's losses by the number of defendants who had been found criminally culpable for liable for those losses, which at the time was about 150. It's now up around 180. But the district court both criticized the government's formula. We're very clear in the district court that we didn't think the court had to use our formula. We thought it was a principled method, a reasonable method of determining restitution, of determining the amount that was Monzel's fair share of her losses, but that the court was not tied to that and could consider other factors. The court rejected the government's formula and also found that the government didn't carry its burden of showing what losses were attributable to Monzel. Let me start there. With respect to the losses that were attributable to Monzel, we agree that he did not increase her losses, that the total amount of losses are established, and that there is a class of defendants who are responsible for those losses. And therefore, we did not feel that we needed to put on any, as a matter of law, no additional evidence was needed to show, to tie him to specific losses. We aren't claiming.
Counsel, just 2 points here. One, the district court concluded the statute was unworkable.
Yes.
So my question is, how did the government view its ability to respond in light of that? And then secondly, when the district court said that the psychologist's report was stale, how did the government view its responsibility at that point?
Okay, with respect to the finding that the statute was unworkable, which the court finds in its written order after the hearing.
So there was no hint of this at the hearing?
Well, there was. I mean, she has said that before, that she finds it very difficult. We think that our formula is workable, and that we did espouse a formula that we thought fairly determines or approximates, as this court said, in a principled method, the amount of losses attributable to Monzel.
Well,
so we think it is workable.
Court disagreed.
Right. We think she erred in doing that.
Well, she gave some. She made some findings about your formula, and why were they clearly erroneous?
Yes. Let me talk about the findings about the
Before
formula.
Before you do that, may I? Would you point me to the portion of our previous opinion that says that you can just use a formula on remand?
Yes, certainly. On page 540, you say, although there's relatively little in the present record to guide its decision-making on this being the amount attributable to Monzel, the district court is free to order the government to submit evidence regarding what losses were caused by Monzel's possession of Amy's image, or to order the government to suggest a formula for determining the proper amount of restitution. And so we went with the or in the formula.
How do you square that with the earlier portion of the opinion that says the government failed to submit any evidence whatsoever regarding the amount of Amy's losses attributed to Monzel?
The portion of what the court, I think, there was saying is that we have not submitted evidence that shows that Monzel caused specific therapy sessions, and we would agree with that. We have not submitted evidence showing that Amy needs an additional 10 therapy sessions because of Monzel's conduct. We would agree with that.
Evidence regarding the amount of Amy's losses attributable. A formula is not evidence. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
But the court also.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that, yes. Yeah.
So if you hadn't submitted evidence the first time around, and you haven't submitted evidence, any additional evidence, then why isn't that the law of the case?
We did submit evidence the first time,
No. If you hadn't submitted evidence regarding the amount of Amy's losses attributable to Monzel, and that's what the court said, and you didn't submit any additional evidence on remand, then why is it not so that that statement that the court made, whatever, in 2011 is still accurate?
Well, I think that what we are agreeing that we haven't submitted it, but we don't think we need it, and we don't think this court said we needed it. What we think the court said was that we can use a formula to divide her aggregate losses. And this is what a number of other courts of appeals have held, and we think that's consistent with this court's decision. This court granted Amy's petition because the district court had clearly and indisputably erred in not awarding restitution of at least of over $5,000, where the district court had found that the losses attributable to Monzel were more than $5,000.
Back to Judge Rogers' question, if you would.
On the 2008 or the unworkable?
Both. The unworkable.
On the unworkable. We think that the statute is workable, and that several courts now have so held. The Sixth Circuit in Gamble, the Second Circuit in the Hagerman case, the Eighth Circuit in Fast, the Seventh Circuit in Larinetta. The formula that we have for apportioning in Kearney, also in the First Circuit, there's been a lot of favorable decisions lately that recognize that the way to handle restitution in these child pornography cases is through apportionment, is to divide the aggregate losses by some pool. There may be some dispute at this time as to what that pool is, but that it's finding the fair share for the defendant of the losses, and that makes the statute workable. In terms of the second part of the question that Judge Rogers asked about the 2008 materials, the materials in this case, Amy's position here is that her losses flow from the fact that there is this whole class of defendants out there who are viewing her image and causing her constant trauma, a resurgence of the trauma, emotional harm, an inability to settle down and go to school, to go to work, to live in society, because she is always worried.
All right, so the district court said, and the defendant made the point, that what the defendant did occurred after the psychologist wrote her report. And the district court said, given the passage of time, the report was stale. And so my question is, with that view, what was the government's understanding of what happens next?
The court said that the estimates were stale, but with respect to, because we now would have concrete information with respect to a couple years. But even if that's correct, you still don't award zero restitution.
All right, let me just put my cards on the table here. As you know, I was on the first panel.
Yes.
I don't think we thought we would see this case in the posture it's in now. And from reading the record on remand, it appears to have, been somewhat of a more stilted proceeding than we might have anticipated, maybe erroneously so. But in any event, when I look at what's going on around the country with other courts, both at the circuit level and the district court level, it's perfectly clear that they are holding restitution hearings, that updated reports are being presented, that some of the objections that have been raised, the government has responded to. And I'm just not clear why this one formula that the government proposed, at least in the district court, and there's some questions to whether the government is somewhat modifying its formula, why there wasn't a little more flexibility to assist the district court in trying to follow the mandate of this court.
One point I'd like to make, joint appendix page 663, the district court said very clearly that she never asked the government to expand the record in any way, and that she did actually on page 593 and page 594 and 95 of the record, she credited the materials that Amy had submitted originally. In terms of staleness, I think as Mr.
Okay, I know the district court said she never asked the government. We indicated in our opinion, of course, that the district court could ask the government. All right, so I'm just trying to understand what's happening here on remand, because I can see if we were to send this case back, it would come back to us, not on the issue of was the amount, did the court err, or was it an abuse of discretion to order the amount of restitution it did. But I don't see that's what's happening in these other circuits and district courts.
I think it varies from case to case. But as we read the court's opinion, we read that phrase of or suggest a formula that's what was the most appropriate thing for us to do here, was to come up with a formula for apportioning the losses. And that's what we've also offered in those
formula in the district court?
In the district court, our formula was Amy's uncompensated losses, the ones that she hasn't collected yet, divided by the number of defendants who have been found to be criminally responsible for those losses.
150 at that time.
But
now you've proposed a different formula on appeal. Because now you say not only do you have to do that calculation, but then you say it's best determined, the liability of the defendant is best determined by using a multi-factor approach, which accounts for the victim's aggregate losses, the number of defendants, whether the defendant distributed the image, whether the defendant stalked the victim or attempted to contact her, the number of victim images the defendant possessed, and any other factor that might have increased the harm. Did you present that
to the district court? We did present the fact that some courts were using a multi-factor test. In this case, none of those factors are relevant to Monzel. They just drop out. He didn't distribute Amy's image. He didn't stalk her. He only had one or two of her images. He didn't have a large number of her images. So those factors actually drop out here.
You start with the
amount
from the formula, and then you can adjust that amount based on the factors.
That's exactly right, Judge Kavanaugh.
Is that your government's position consistently throughout the country?
That is our position consistently. And if I just may make one tweak to we suggested that the division should be her remaining losses, the losses that haven't been paid yet divided by the defendants. We actually think, and we're not going back on that for this case,
right,
but across the country, what we are arguing is that it's all of her losses divided by defendants, because if you're removing the losses that have already been paid from the numerator, you should also be removing defendants from the denominator. It's very difficult to do that because defendants tend to make partial payments. And so math, just as a matter of pure math, we think it's appropriate to use as your numerator the full amount of her losses. And that is what we are arguing across the country. But because we argued a different, a more favorable position to Monzel here, we're not asking to change that in this case.
I wanted to make sure I understand that. The number, whatever it was, one million something that she had, that wasn't just the awards, that's the actual amount collected?
Yes, it's not the awards. We are not basing this on awards. That was the amount she has collected. She has collected $1.6 million so far. She is asking for over $3
million. Why shouldn't it be on the amount of the – why shouldn't you deduct the amount of the awards as opposed to what she's collected so far?
Well, the court – as we said, there's no one option here for the district court, and that's what the court did in Kearney. In Kearney, the court divided the awards by the number of defendants. And it sort of used the Olympic system by taking out the highest and the lowest and then average the remaining awards. That's also a possible option. We actually think our option more directly ties the defendant, his culpability it's better does that, ties him to the losses, because it's looking at not just awards but her actual losses and dividing them over the people who have been found to be culpable for those losses.
In terms of what we're going to say in this case, I'm focused not just on getting this case right, but on setting forth something that's going to stand and be coherent. And so your position generally, the government's position generally throughout the country is total losses over total number of defendants.
Right, defendants who have been found to be
responsible.
So what happens to the first defendant that's convicted?
Well, I think the first defendant, of course, we're all the way up to 180, so we don't have to worry about it for
but
this.
I'm just following up on Judge Kavanaugh's question, which is the future application. So, so the hypothetical is that this is the first person that's been convicted, and the loss, the total loss is $3,600,000. So you divide by one?
Well, that's where the flexibility comes in with our multi-factor test. We think that in that situation, the court can certainly make an adjustment so that the first defendant does not have the full burden of all the losses. But the other point is that if there's only one defendant, chances are that the victim isn't going to have that large a number
there's
of losses.
But there's always a first conviction. There was a first conviction here, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a first conviction here, but again, that's
so what do you?
That's why we say that this is the formula is just a starting point. It's not an ending point.
But what if it may not be a coherent starting point? Is if the first defendant, let's just use $3 million,
right?
As a hypothetical, the first defendant gets $3 million order, gets a $3 million order, and then defendant two, 1.5.
Right. Absolutely. It drops down pretty fast.
I know, but the total amount of the awards is well above the losses.
The total number of awards is going to be above the losses. I mean, even it is so far, because Amy has received awards of full restitution from a number of defendants, not that any defendants have paid full restitution. But it does total more. But the issue here is just trying to come up with an approximation of the defendant's responsibility. And in those cases, those first 20 cases where it's going to be too much for the defendant, that's where the multi-factor test comes in. In part,
it
comes in for another.
Say if you don't know, if you're the district court and you don't know how many future defendants are going to be.
I think that where you...
So, and you would say, well, that's in the multi-factor test, but okay, I'm going to guess that they're going to be 10, or do you have some sense at that point?
Well, I think it's a reasonable approximation. If they're circulating on the Internet, the chances are that they're going to continue to circulate.
And why not apply that here? Why restrict it to just the initial calculation to the ones that are convicted? Why not apply that approach here?
We are applying that approach here. We're using this formula as a starting point, but we're saying that the court can consider other factors. Our argument here, Judge Randolph, is that the district court erred in ordering no restitution. We're not saying that the district court was required to use our formula. We're saying we came back with a formula that we think was principled and reasonable.
Well, again, we're asking not just about this case. We're trying to get something clear here. And I'm just not sure how this is going to work out in practice.
If you applied your approach and you had the first defendant and the court didn't make adjustments and ordered restitution of $3.6 million, and we applied the Tierney approach, then any future defendant's liability would be zero. Does that make any sense?
No, the future liability would not be zero.
If you applied instead of the amount collected, the amount awarded.
No, the Kearney approach is an averaging approach. Yeah. So you would average the awards over the number of the defendants. So if there was one award of $3.6 million and two defendants, the second...
No, one defendant. In the past, yeah.
Right. Then it would be that defendant, using the Kearney approach, that defendant would pay the full amount. The second defendant would pay 1.5 because you would be averaging awards. And then the third defendant would be the average of $3 million and $1.5 million, and so would come in somewhere in between. I mean, that's the Kearney approach. We're not
advocating
that.
Why isn't that totally arbitrary? Why isn't that totally arbitrary? And after all, there are two interests here, and the first is compensating the victim.
Yes.
But the second is also having a rational system of sentencing, because this is part of sentencing.
Your Honor, we're not advocating the Kearney approach. We don't think that that is the most rational system. It was applied in that case, but the other courts have not been following the Kearney approach, and we're not advocating that. We think that the fairer approach is to look at her losses and divide them among, on the date of sentencing, the number of defendants who we know have been held to be responsible for those losses, and then make adjustments as are necessary for fairness to the defendant, if he's more culpable because he was distributing and therefore probably was responsible for a greater share of those losses. The court has flexibility.
But if there, again, if the first defendant is ordered $3 million, sorry, and then you get a couple years later and there are 30 total defendants, and the 30th defendant's ordered to pay $100,000, what rational sense does it make to have, for the same harm caused, the same act done, one get a $3 million award and order, and another get $100,000.
We don't think the court. We think the court can look to the fact that there will be continuing defendants, that this will continue to occur.
So to lower the first award is what you're saying, but
yes.
How?
At what point do you stop lowering?
Yes.
That's what you're asking. Mm-hmm. I think that certainly by the point where you get down around in a 20,000, 10,000 range, you stop lowering, because I think those are fair.
And at what point do you amounts. Start lowering? That's another difficult thing to figure out. Or how much do you lower?
Well, so that's right.
It seems like a little bit of a dart throw. Maybe that's inevitable.
I think that is inevitable. We haven't had to address that yet. Because right now the victims who are seeking restitution are well along and we haven't had a new one where we've had to reach that yet.
Has the department proposed anything to Congress to provide a better system here?
The department is working on some legislative solutions, but nothing has gone to the Hill yet.
Okay. Let me just ask, along these questions that we're focusing on, some of the circuits have talked about joint and several liability. We didn't reach that question, decide that question. Other circuits have discussed, at least from the back end, where you have a number of defendants who have already been ordered to pay restitution to Amy or Vicky, the circuit acknowledging that it doesn't need to worry about the current award because it will not take, say, Amy's total recovery above the $3 million mark. And I was wondering, what about the first defendant, where the evidence presumably shows the nature of the damage, it has the type of economic projections that we have here, and it has the treatment projections? Is there a problem with finality of sentencing for a district court in ordering restitution to have some type of condition that would adjust the amount of restitution in light of what happens in the future?
I don't think the court would have the authority to adjust the restitution, with one exception. 3664D5 does allow a court to increase where the victim comes back later with new losses. So, but otherwise, no, I don't think the court can adjust.
Looking at a case that's recently been in the news where a defendant's sentence may be reduced, is there a process to go back to the sentencing judge and say, in light of the fact that five more people have been convicted, the amount of restitution ordered for the first defendant should be reduced?
There is no process to do that, and I think the case you're talking about was actually a remand from the Court of Appeals.
Yes, it was, and that's why I'm wondering whether, no one's argued this, but in trying to figure out how to do this in a sensible way, and I'll ask the defendant's attorney about this as well. Just are there possibilities along this line as well?
But if I could ask, say one thing on this, that most of these defendants, most of them are indigent, or at least they don't have very much money, and so they ultimately, they don't pay that much on their awards. They pay a schedule. Once Amy has collected.
Evidence to that effect?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Did you introduce
evidence? No, I apologize. I did not.
I mean, one case where the defendant paid the whole amount.
No, the defendant hasn't paid.
I mean, not the $3 million, but $134,000.
That was only one-third of his award, so he still has two-thirds outstanding.
That's not an indigent defendant.
No, that's not an indigent. Some of the defendants
Washington
do have money.
The Washington Post this morning has a front-page article about a prominent doctor who was just arrested for
that. So that's correct.
How do we know that most are indigent?
I apologize. I shouldn't have. There's nothing in the record to say that. But my only point here was that Mr. Monzel, for instance, is represented by the federal defender, that he's going to be paying, if he is ever ordered restitution, at a fairly low, slow pace. And eventually, Amy will be compensated for all of her losses. At that point, for all the defendants, rich or poor, their obligation to keep paying will end because she cannot collect more than the total of her losses. So there is going to be an end point. I think that this is sort of in partial response to Judge Rogers, that although you can't go back and change the sentence for later events, there will be a termination of the obligation to pay once she has received all of her.
How does that happen mechanically?
Mechanically, the Department of Justice is tracking the payments. And once the once we hit the total, we will alert the courts and the defendants, I guess, as well, not to collect any more money and tell the defendants that they don't have to pay any more money.
All right.
So we are keeping track.
Thank you. Let us hear from counsel for Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. Paul Cassell from the University of Utah Appellate Clinic, along with James Marsh from the Marsh Law Firm. I think it's useful to remember how we got here. 2 years ago, Amy was awarded only $5,000 in restitution by the district court. She came to this court seeking appellate protection and her right to full restitution for $3.3 million in losses. She argued then it's impossible to take her losses and assign them to particular defendants. And this court rejected Amy's position. This court said, contrary to her argument that these are indivisible injuries, they are, in fact, divisible injuries. And it sent it back then to the district court to divide it up. And what happened on remand? Amy's reward was reduced from $5,000 to zero, the cost of her going to this court seeking protection. We come back to this court seeking protection, not just for $5,000, but for the full amount of her losses. How are we going to sort this out? What kind of formula should we use? We think the answer to that question is quite clear. Congress has already set forward a formula in Mosh's Law, 18 U.S.C. 2255. Congress has said, doggone it, whenever there is a victim of a crime of this nature, the minimum amount of damages that she has suffered is $150,000. We think that the district court clearly and indisputably erred in failing to even consider that argument. Let me be clear. We're not saying that the district court had to award $150,000. We are saying the district court had to consider our argument. Now, in fairness to the district court, why did it fail to consider the argument? Well, the government—
I'm not sure I understand that. Had to consider it. What if it considered it and rejected it?
Then we would be back on it.
So what's the legal significance beyond just considering that?
The legal significance is that that is a benchmark set by Congress of the minimum damage amount. If the court says, well, in this particular case, there's an unusual circumstance or attorney's fees or psychiatric reports, whatever it may be, it can deviate from that with some to some extent. But that is a principled, non-arbitrary.
Deviate in either direction?
Yes, there could be more damages.
Yeah. Mr. Cassell, would you explain if Amy did receive, if the government won a restitution order against this particular defendant, could your client then sue that defendant and collect $150,000?
There would be the possibility of moving in that direction as well, but there would clearly be an offset. If Amy has already recovered her losses from a defendant, he's entitled to offset that in a civil judgment.
So no matter what happens in any amount less than $150,000 ordered by the district court as part of this defendant's sentence, your client can still go in and have a minimum collection in a civil case of up to $150,000 minimum for every defendant that has been charged and convicted, or for that matter, anybody that had her
Yeah, in theory, the answer, of course, is yes. In practice, many of these defendants are indigent, and the cost of litigating to collect against Mr. Monzel, for example, would probably far exceed the kind of collections that Amy would ultimately
obtain. Well, yeah, but if that's the case, then any order that the district court issues in terms of restitution is going to not be satisfied either. So
it's going to be satisfied at a modest amount over a period of time.
What they earn in prison? What is that?
What they earn in prison is $25 a quarter, but of course Mr. Monzel is going to be released, and then at that point we'll have gainful employment, and the award will probably
But that argument also applies to the $150,000.
Right. I mean, the reason we're seeking full restitution is that there are occasionally wealthy defendants out there who have the ability to make sizable payments. The vast bulk of Amy's collections have come from just three cases where there were wealthy defendants who were able to start making significant payments towards establishing her loss. But Amy is entitled to collect against everyone. There has to be, I think, as all of you have been pointing out this morning, some sort of a principled approach to this problem. The principled approach to this problem is to follow what Congress has said in Mosh's law. Congress has said that the presumptive minimum damage amount for every one of these crimes is $150,000. The district court should be reversed for not even considering that argument. The government withheld our letter, which laid this argument out in great detail, deciding that, well, we're not going to present that for one reason. It's an argument that's different than the argument we're advancing. We think, at the very least, one of the things this court should do as part of its decision is instruct the government that it cannot withhold restitution information that a victim is trying to submit to the district court, particularly in a case like this. And Judge Rogers, I believe that helps to answer part of your question. Was there an argument about the information here being too stale? Well, we were deprived of the opportunity to present our new letter to the district court laying out our position just a couple of weeks.
I don't understand that. I mean, the district court criticized Amy's counsel for not assisting the district court. If
right.
There were letters, why couldn't they have been presented to the district court?
We wrote out a detailed letter with our position, and we sent it to the assistant U.S. attorney handling the case.
I mean letters, for instance, updated psychologist reports and things like that.
We were never asked to provide those.
Well, does everybody have to be asked?
Well, and this was a situation where we presented information that the district court found, and I'm quoting here, a great deal of evidence.
I'm focusing on the district court's comment here that on remand, Amy's counsel provided no assistance to the district
court. Right, and that's because our letter attempting to provide assistance to the district court was withheld by the government.
But that letter was going to repeat an argument that you had previously made about Masha's law to the district court. It wasn't going to address the concerns about staleness.
We were never asked to address concerns about staleness. If the district court had said, we want your latest psychiatric reports, if we wanted to know, did Amy go to counseling last week, we would have gladly provided that. But we were working on the assumption that this was a remand from this court to increase the amount of her award above $5,000. This court didn't say, well, let's make sure we get updated information. And so we went forward on the basis of what we thought the mandate was, which was to award Amy more than $5,000. And the price of Amy exercising her right to appellate protection has been to reduce her award from $5,000 to zero. We think that this court should use the same sorts of presumptions against vindictiveness that it would give to defendants. If a defendant comes seeking the protection of this court, he cannot be made worse off as a result of having sought appellate protection.
You agree, I take it, that the burden is on the government to show the loss that this particular defendant caused to the victim.
Yes.
Okay. If the government fails to show that by a preponderance of the evidence, then, and the district court orders zero restitution as a result, what's your position then?
Our position is that the district court clearly and indisputably erred because there is already a finding from Congress that Amy has suffered $150,000 in damages as a result of the defendant's crime. That is based on fact-finding by the legislative branch that the judicial branch is obligated to
credit.
So
the government always satisfies its burden of proof in every case?
Yes, with respect to a damages of $150,000. Of course, Amy is asking for $3.3 million, and she would have the burden of going above and beyond that. But at the very least, the district court is obligated to award an amount of restitution with reference to the $150,000. If you're worried about future cases, that is a principled non-arbitrary, easily administrable way of dealing with this issue. We respectfully submit.
It's just not in this statute. That's the.
Well, it's one. It's just four sections away. It's in 2255, and it cross-references. Right. Please understand that 2255 cross-references 2259. It is part of the same chapter. It is a comprehensive scheme that ought to be looked at, not piecemeal. Remember what the district court has said, as Judge Rogers pointed out. This statute is unworkable. That's certainly one way to read the statute. The way that we propose is completely workable. Now, as between choosing an approach that is unworkable and workable, we would respectfully submit that this court should assume that Congress has put in place a scheme that makes victims whole, that makes guilty criminals pay for the cost of their losses, and comes up with a scheme that the courts can easily administer.
What is the status of getting Congress on these kinds of cases to change the law to make it more clear? Are you aware of efforts going on in Congress?
There's been discussion. No legislation's been introduced. Of course, we're going to go to the Supreme Court and argue that the simple way to fix this is to reverse this court's decision in the first Monzel decision and simply award victims the entirety of their losses. Once again, that's a very simple system.
Well, cert was denied, so.
Because it was interlocutory. The government said, you know, this court hadn't finally sorted out the issue,
okay.
So.
Thank you.
Well, before you sit down, what is your position on the government's formula?
Our position is that we would prefer that we get some restitution rather than others. But remember, this is a formula that's going to regress towards zero over time, and it's not going to provide Amy full compensation. The only way that she's got, I know that you heard the number 1.6 million, you think, well, look, she's doing fine. Please remember, those are from a handful of defendants who are very wealthy. If the government's position was in place earlier in this case, we would not have anywhere near $1.6 million. Our collections would be far, far lower than that because each defendant would be paying just a trivial amount in each case. The only way to make this statute work is to either give Amy the full amount of her losses or, at a minimum, something like $150,000, because otherwise the collections are going to be so small that the courts will be dealing with this for literally decades, and Amy will never be made whole.
But if every defendant paid, and I know that's not going to happen, but if every defendant paid, then you would be whole at some
Correct.
Point.
If they paid, but the fact, and there is evidence in the record that this man is being represented by the federal defenders, and the only way that he can do that is because he's indigent, and that, of course, is the vast majority of defendants in the federal criminal justice system. They are indigent. They're not going to pay $3.3 million. And so we need to come up with something that reflects that reality.
I need to ask you a couple more questions, factual questions, because I'm not going to be able to ask the public defender. I don't expect them to know. But when was the first photograph taken?
Approximately 13 years ago.
13 years ago. And do you know when it was first broadcast on the Internet?
I would estimate approximately 13 years ago. She was photographed specifically for child pornography. She was forced to hold up signs about what was going on and things like that to satisfy the market.
What I'm wondering, just to follow up, is if you have 13 years and 180 convictions so far, why can't you project out that for the next 13 years you'll get another 180 convictions? So then you divide it by 360 instead of 180.
The reason is, and again, this may be more information than you want, apparently the interest in the kinds of young girls that these criminals out there have fluctuates. At one point in time, they're interested in Amy images. At another point in time, they're interested in Vicky images. At another point in time, so you can't say for sure what's going to happen. Also, unfortunately, these criminals are very sophisticated. So the stream of convictions that's been going on right now is because law enforcement has been successful in penetrating their efforts. They may come up with new encryption devices, and at that point, we would not be certain about getting further convictions.
Yeah, but certainty isn't the standard. So.
What's that?
Certainty is not the standard.
Right, and that's why we think that the way that this court should proceed, we argued 2 years ago, should have been to give Amy the full amount of her losses. We respect that we've lost that claim, and now our position is $150,000 is the congressional finding that the district court essentially ignored in awarding Amy zero.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear counsel for the defendant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. In this court's original opinion in Monzel, this court said a few different things. It said that the government had made no showing as to the amount of Amy's losses traceable to Monzel. The court said The government failed to submit any evidence whatsoever regarding the amount of Amy's losses attributable to Monzel. And then the court said, we expect the government to do more this time around to aid the district court. The government submitted no additional materials to aid the district court. In fact, Amy in her brief says the government did less the second time around by not submitting Amy's letter, which, by the way, contained no evidence. It just contained further legal arguments. With respect to whether the statute's unworkable, it was not just Judge Kessler. So Judge Kessler was essentially faced with a situation where this court told her to consider new evidence that was going to be submitted to make the proximate cause analysis that this court ordered, and the government submitted nothing new. She was in the same position as she was in originally when the case went up the first time and the court said the evidence was insufficient.
As you know, the judge found that $5,000 did not cover the full amount. So that was the context in which this court was deciding the case, that the judge had made a determination that $5,000 was not enough. So we weren't in a context where the district court had suggested the statute was unworkable.
She had found $5,000, but she had just said that number. She had just plucked that number. She said, I noticed a number of other courts have awarded $5,000 as nominal damages, and essentially said that and admitted, I can't connect that up to anything, any proximate cause analysis, but I'm awarding that. She did then say, I think the damages are more, but she gave no basis for that. And I think on remand, faced with this court's legal standard and direction, and faced with the fact that nobody had submitted new evidence to her, she felt that she had no evidence upon which to make any award at all. And the government itself, when the government criticizes her for saying the statute is unworkable, the government at the remand proceedings at page 658 of the joint appendix said, I certainly acknowledge that it would be easy to find the statute essentially unworkable under most of the circumstances which arise in these type of cases. So it wasn't just the district court that found the statute unworkable, the government found the statute unworkable. Amy, in her brief, criticizes the government's suggested methodology in the district court and calls it anomalous and idiosyncratic in her brief. And she says at page 43 of her brief, it's perplexing what the figure.
What brief is that, Mr. Kramer?
Amy's brief, on Amy's lodged intervener brief, yeah, or amicus brief.
We haven't quite decided whether to accept that brief.
I think, obviously, both the government and ourselves have argued that she should not be allowed to intervene, but I guess it's being treated as an amicus brief, but it's certainly a pleading before the court in which she makes these statements for whatever status the court is going to give it. Nobody's objected to it being filed as an amicus brief.
Mr. Monzel's position originally, as I recall, was that the district court should award no more than $100. So an argument wasn't being made that the statute was unworkable. That's all I'm trying to establish here.
No, that's true.
During our oral argument, the thought was, there could be expert testimony, at a hearing on remand and all those sorts of things.
The government originally said at the status conferences before the final remand hearing where the legal arguments were fully developed that they were going to call 10 witnesses. They ended up, for whatever reason, calling no witnesses. So for whatever reason, evidence that was going to be presented went away.
You heard my questions about sentencing, draw on your expertise here about the first defendant and the statutory command that full restitution be ordered. Assume for the moment that there is evidence to show that the government had the evidence from the economic expert and the psychologist to support the $3 million. What is your response?
Well, this court decided originally that it can only be the losses attributable to Mr. Monzel in the proximate cause and rejected the argument that he could be liable for the entire $3 million, that there had been no showing that he was.
How do you determine the losses attributed to your client?
Well, I think that's why the government said to Judge Kessler, this statute, I can easily see why this statute is unworkable. First of all, clearly
Is there no answer to that, in your view?
Certainly a number of several courts, I think it's at page 28 of our brief, several courts have said that there's no answer to that. It's unworkable. There's no way to do it. I mean, one court took a 50% figure and said that was the amount attributable to her uncle, who was the person who filmed her and first distributed it, and said at least 50% is attributable to him. So that, and then, of course, you have the people. There's no evidence that Mr. Monzel even viewed her image, and he had one image of her on the computer. No evidence that he, and of course, the government agreed that he didn't distribute her image at all.
Right, but he pled guilty to possession of her image.
No, he pled guilty to possession of child pornography. And her image, I'm sorry, yes, but not that he had viewed her image. There was no evidence one way or the other, and the government admitted we have no idea.
You mean it could have been downloaded on his computer, but he never opened it?
I think he had 8,000 images, and there was no evidence presented of how many of those he had ever even opened, and or how many times any of them had been opened. And it may be impossible to determine some of those facts.
You know, it sounds like the more you argue, and I just throw this out as maybe amusing, is that not funny, but just thinking about it, is that because of the way the statute is framed, and Mr. Cassell says what we ought to do is put 150,000 as the number, and 5,000, Judge Kessler originally said, is that what Congress is asking us to do is perform a legislative function here. Because there's no other way that you can make any sense out of this. To set a number like a statute of limitations or like a liquidated damage number. But that's not a judicial function, it seems to me. That's a legislative function.
No, I think we said in our briefs that Amy's argument is with Congress, really, not this court or the district court. Because there's the government, even the government's multi-factor formula, which they have in their brief on appeal, which of course is not what they argued in the district court and is completely different than what they argued in the district court. And just a week ago in front of Judge Bates in a case, they came in with not this argument, but with the argument of divided by the number of people, not the multi-factor approach. So even their multi-factor approach, we set out a number of factors that distinguish culpability. But how do you allocate a certain amount of money to the fact that somebody distributed it once as opposed to somebody distributed to 50 other people? I mean, there's obviously huge difference in culpability there. Or to people like Mr. Monzel, who simply possessed it, did not distribute it. That was stipulated in the record, that he did not distribute it.
The Supreme Court has recognized the difference, too, in the Ferber and Osborne case, I guess.
Oh, clearly, I think the distribution of it is far more culpable. And of course, her uncle is the person who originally sold the images to some other man, unidentified man, and that's how it all started. When the government told the district court it was unworkable, I think in almost all situations like this, I think they were absolutely correct. And I think this court's direction that you have to find, which is what the statute says, that you have to find what damages he proximately caused, and that Judge Kessler was faced with the same evidence on remand that this court had said originally was insufficient to prove that, then she was perfectly justified in saying that there's no evidence before me on which I can find that anything that Mr. Monzel did proximately caused.
Let's assume we accept that, but isn't the $5,000 a floor then? Because the $5,000 was not, your client didn't challenge that.
Well, he hasn't had the opportunity yet to challenge that for,
oh, yes,
this
he
is
did.
Not
he,
his appeal.
Upon the original sentencing, he could have done that.
He could have
appealed. He could have appealed, isn't that right?
He did file an appeal from the original sentencing. The restitution decision was made later, as you know, that's the subject of the first section of our brief. And there's an argument about whether the original notice of appeal would cover that situation or not. But then when it was subsequently so he hasn't actually had his direct appeal yet. There's an argument about whether he needs to file a new notice of appeal needed to or not. The Supreme Court left that question open in Dolan. So, and the mandamus petition and the government's appeal gave him no opportunity to argue that. So he hasn't had an opportunity to argue that yet. But this court in Monzel said the district court should, and of course right now there's no restitution.
Why couldn't he have cross-appealed?
Cross-appealed, well, now because there's no, this is an appeal from an award of zero. So there was nothing for him to cross-appeal in this appeal.
Oh, in this case, yeah. Yes. The other was just pure mandamus, right?
Yeah, and the other was pure mandamus. There was no opportunity for him to, whatever it would be called. I'm not even sure what it would be called. So there was no, so that's still an open question. But this court told the district court, to answer your initial question, this court told the district court to start anew. And I think that the district court realized that it threw out the $5,000 figure as a nominal award. And then when it was told that it had to have evidence to support the proximate cause analysis, said, well, it's just not there. There's nothing there that I can connect that Mr. Monzel proximately caused. I can't reinstate the $5,000 because that was based on just a nominal award not connected to proximate cause. So if there's in the integrity of the situation, if there was no proof of proximate cause, the award had to be zero, and that's where she ended up. She said originally I awarded as nominal. She did say, I think it's more, but she gave no connection to any evidence to show it was more.
The district court seemed to leave open the possibility that had the psychologist's report been updated, then perhaps evidence might have been before the district court regarding the contribution to the harm from possession.
I think she did leave, clearly said that might have been one way they could have shown the proximate cause. In the Ninth Circuit, in the Kennedy case, that's actually what happened. Amy, no, but there was, Vicky came back and said, when I learned of Kennedy and his viewing of the images, I was informed, and it caused extra costs to be incurred. And the Ninth Circuit affirmed that and said that's the kind of evidence that obviously shows proximate cause. But they affirmed the no award to Vicky on the remand because she had not submitted any additional evidence, as in this case. I do want to say that the district court in this case did consider Marsh's Law. On the original go-around of sentencing, before this court's opinion in Monzel, she said, I understand that's a civil statute. That states that $150,000 shall be awarded for liability in civil cases, but how could I interpret that in light of proximate cause? And then she said,
is that in the transcript you're reading?
It's at page 431 of the joint appendix, and then there's further discussion at pages 585 to 588 that the joint appendix. And she said, I don't think any judge has actually awarded that $150,000. So she was aware of it and realized that it did not fit into the proximate cause analysis. And then didn't give any. Matter of fact, in the original mandamus petition, Amy raised Marsh's Law, and this court did not address it in its opinion. So it's clear that Judge Kessler originally rejected it, and there was no need for her to consider it again. She said that's a civil damages statute. No judge, at least at that time, had awarded any amount based on it, and it doesn't have any relation to proximate cause. That's the main thing, of course. And the statute provides, as this court said originally, under 3664E, that it is the government's burden to prove the damages suffered as a proximate cause result of Mr. Monzel's actions. She knew of Marsh's Law, and she said it really doesn't. First of all, it's a civil remedy, and she's also said it doesn't fit into the proximate cause analysis. I'm sorry.
So, is the defendant's position that the government's formula is, arbitrary, or is it that were there an evidentiary basis, such as Vicky presented in the Ninth Circuit case, then the formula would apply?
I think the formula is arbitrary in a number of ways, and I think Amy says it best in her brief at one point when she
says...
All right,
I was just trying to be clear, is it arbitrary as a threshold consideration and also as a subsequent consideration in light of evidence presented?
Yes, because in the Ninth Circuit case, evidence was presented about what further losses Vicki had incurred, and that was the amount. It was not based on this division number.
My theory, my hypothetical would be the evidence is, yes, I suffered additional trauma as a result of knowing that people were possessing this on their computers. And there's psychological evidence that says, indeed, that is so, and the treatments are going to increase. But there's also evidence that a number of defendants have had this image on their computers. So wouldn't you divide it by the number of... I'm just trying to understand how this would work.
I think that's a problem. I don't really understand how the government's method would work. I mean, in the Fifth Circuit in Amy Unknown, the court said that there had been 3,200 cases where Amy's image had been identified by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
You said it's arbitrary, and I think that's going to be an adjective we can use about any formula in this circumstance. So is the upshot of that that we should search for the least arbitrary approach that takes account of the factors, or should we just say zero?
Well, let me give you
in all cases.
Try to answer that by what the government said in the district court. They said approximately 150 defendants, although that may not be an accurate figure. And a letter they submitted to the district court said that underestimates the number 150. And then they said,
I guess to reframe my question, are you saying, gee, the government's approach is arbitrary, they should tweak it and make it better by doing this and that? You're not really saying that. You're saying it's arbitrary and therefore...
Well, I think, I'm sorry.
Or am I missing here?
I think I'm saying two things, and I'm sorry I'm not making them clear. First of all, I think that this formula is inappropriate because it bears no relationship to proximate cause. It's just taking a number and dividing by another number. I think it's arbitrary for a number of reasons, which Amy explains well in her brief when she says the government's formula spits out a number that can be entered. This is page 43 of her whatever status the brief has. But Monzel is not in a pool of 150 people who have caused Amy's losses. In this country alone, there are reportedly thousands of criminals who collect the image. And outside this country, there are presumably thousands of others. So Amy herself calls the government's formula, as I said, anomalous, idiosyncratic, and incorrect and arbitrary because it doesn't take account. But also in front of the district court at the remand, and this is at pages 653 to 656 of the joint appendix, the government says there are 150, but Amy has reported that she sought restitution in 733 cases. I guess the methodology, the number of convicted defendants would range somewhere between 150 and 733. There is no better way for us to evaluate it. The middle point between the two figures is 441, so the court might also use that figure as well. I mean, that seems to me to be the height of arbitrariness. Pick any figure in between 150.
I'm just trying to think of analogous situations in tort law. And this is not in tort law, but say, you know, with the 9/11 victims, there were many degrees of injury. And so Mr. Feinberg had a pool of money and had to try to figure out what was an equitable allocation to individuals. Now, it wasn't perfect, but, you know, it was a reasonable person trying to do something reasonable. And sort of that's where we are, it seems to me, that Congress has put this out there, that the circuits and district court judges have struggled with it and come up with different approaches. The government has come up with an approach. So it's not, no one thinks we're going to have perfection here. And there may be cases like the Vicki case in the Ninth Circuit, and there was another district court case where he had a very clear cause and effect. But that's not what proximate cause requires. And the Seventh Circuit made that clear. We made it clear. Prosser's made it clear. And so we're looking for a rational basis here. And Judge Kavanaugh's observation about, you know, any formula can be criticized as arbitrary, but the question is, within the constraints that we're dealing with, what is the most rational and reasonable approach here? Since your client is not arguing or hadn't argued that he didn't cause any harm.
He argued, as this court said, had he not had that image on his computer, the loss to Amy, the amount of Amy's losses would have been the same, whether he had that image on his computer or not.
Well, you know, the argument was his possession is part of the market that's created. So, you know, whether he looks at the photo or not is irrelevant.
Not even whether he looks at it, but whether he even had it or not. And I understand, of course.
Well, he pled guilty. I mean, we've got to take that.
But bound by the proximate cause analysis this court set out, I think these numbers are arbitrary, especially since the government said that the district court essentially, well, first of all, these, and as I said, the Fifth Circuit just said that there were 3,200 cases identified with Amy's image.
But they were applying a different standard, so.
No, but they were setting.
Just the factual information.
They gave the factual information that hurt over, I think, 35,000 images of her had been identified in 3,200 different defendants.
This is sentencing. It's not tort law. And a good deal of sentencing by a good many thoughtful people is arbitrary. I mean, one guy commits an offense and they get 20 years, and somebody else gets 5 months for something that might be considered just as harmful. And the whole sentencing system is shot through with arbitrary standards. The mandatory minimums have been criticized rightly by a lot of people. A lot of people think as totally arbitrary. So why should? Where does that rule, other than the proximate cause requirement? Is there any law that says a sentence can't be arbitrary?
Well, I think there's lots of law that says a sentence can't be arbitrary. Whether they are in fact arbitrary, I understand, is a different argument than whether it can be legally shown that it's arbitrary. And I think that may be the, when you're saying one judge gives somebody 5 years and one judge gives somebody 20
exactly.
years, that may appear arbitrary, but there, of course, may be reasons for that. Be arbitrary.
Before the sentencing guideline, each judge developed over a period of time their own internal rules that they tried to be consistent from one defendant to another in terms of culpability and sentence and so on and so forth. And that was one of the reasons, because the arbitrariness was from judge to judge to judge, as opposed to within. And that's one of the reasons why the sentencing guidelines were passed. But they're only, you know, guidelines now. So.
No, I think that's true. But another difference, though, is restitution is solely a creature of statute. And when it's governed by this proximate cause analysis, as Congress declared, that's what the courts have to follow, and that's as a matter of fact, Amy complains that what Judge Kessler did is follow this court's directions. Amy says the district court heeded this court's instructions and followed this court's instructions. She says that both in her mandamus petition and in her brief, that's their argument, that the district court followed this court's instructions. And I would say, Judge Rogers, in answer to your question about 9/11, there was no question, I think, he may have had to make some determinations about proximate cause, whether an injury was pre-existing or if it was. But all that happened there then is what may happen, what probably should happen here, but may be unworkable, is that he could determine if somebody obviously lost a limb, that's different than somebody who had a broken leg and somebody in the severity of the injury. And that's what we put in our brief that was not done in the district court, I might add, that clearly there's a difference in culpability between her uncle and everybody else, and then probably between the initial distributors and just people who distribute it widely as opposed to somebody who's saying.
Well, I think that's what the district courts have been addressing.
And that's what I think Judge Kessler said in the end. I have no evidence to tie this to in this case, and consistent with this court's instruction in Monzel, and that's what Amy says in her brief, that the district court heeded the this court's instruction and follow this court's instruction, and that's what's wrong. They contend that the district, Amy says the district court did follow this court's instructions, but this court's instructions were incorrect.
Thank you very much. All right. Counsel for the government, give you a couple of minutes.
Yes, Your Honor, just a couple quick points. One is that although Mr. Kramer argues today that the test is unworkable, he actually advanced a similar test in his brief. He had a multi-factor test on page 36. His only disagreement was with our divisor. He said it should be divided among all the people we haven't found, the people with encrypted files that we will never find, the future people, so that he wanted a much larger divisor, which he acknowledged would lead to very small awards and would never make Amy whole. So again, he has pretty much landed in the same place that we have, except for the divisor. On his point that there was nothing in the record to show that Monzel knew or had viewed Amy's image, he pleaded guilty to an offense that requires knowing possession. And so he admitted knowing possession. They stipulated that Amy's image was one of those, and on page 120 of the joint appendix, he acknowledged in his statement at sentencing that he had viewed the pictures and videos. He said these pictures and videos, which were the pictures and videos to which he was pleading guilty of possessing. In terms of Mr. Kramer's point that Monzel was not required to appeal the $5,000 award, that is incorrect. His initial appeal from the term of imprisonment 6 months earlier was not effective to cover the later restitution award under Rule 4. A premature notice is only effective if it's from an oral order that's later entered on the docket. This was a separate award. He had to file a separate appeal. He didn't do that. And finally, he relies on the Ninth Circuit's Kennedy case, but more recently in the Ninth Circuit, in In re Amy Cantrell, the court found that Amy's papers, which never refer to a particular defendant or any tie to a particular defendant, do establish the causal link. And therefore, the latest law in the Ninth Circuit is that Amy's papers are sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. 1 minute.
I'll try to make this a 1 minute instead of a lawyer's 1 minute.
Judge Randolph, you asked, is there any law about not being arbitrary? The law that controls here is 2259, in which Congress mandates full restitution. This is not a discretionary statute. The district court was obligated to award full restitution. What is the full restitution? We argued it was $3.3 million. We lost last time around when this court said $3.3 million could be divided among various defendants. We think the next logical stopping point is $150,000 in Mosh's law. We heard quotations from Judge Kessler years ago in 2011. Remember why she said Mosh's law didn't apply 2 years ago? No court has accepted that. We then put together a letter saying, yes, courts have accepted that, which the government withheld from Judge Kessler. We think at the very least we're entitled to a remand to have Judge Kessler look at our arguments on that point. And finally, with regard to defense counsel's point that
all district courts, was it district courts that have accepted them?
I'm sorry. Yes, there are district courts, and also there have been individual court of appeals judges. For example, I believe four judges in the Fifth Circuit en banc said that Mosh's law, if you're not going to give Amy the full amount, 10 judges in the Tenth Circuit gave her the full amount. Four judges said, look at Mosh's law.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.